Welcome to another exciting episode of NID's Knowledge, this one being Real Space Strategy Edition. This podcast is produced by the National Institute for Deterrence Studies, where we are advancing peace, promoting stability, and helping you to think deterrence. Each week, we will inform you about the latest in space strategy and its importance to our national defense. In the past few decades, nuclear weapons and space weapons non-proliferation efforts have proven ineffective. As a result, the spread of nuclear weapons and space weapons have emerged from natural causes of state interest. This means that despite norms and globalization efforts meant to limit the spread of such weapons, normal dynamics of fear and insecurity that have long characterized international affairs have led to nuclear weapons returning for a second act, and in our case of this topic, space nuclear-related weapons, such as ASATs and things. Thomas Schelling stated that there is a tendency in our planning to confuse the unfamiliar with the improbable. The contingency we have not considered looks strange. What looks strange is thought improbable, and what is improbable need not to be considered seriously, end quote. So now with the shift to a strategic environment in which nuclear weapons technologies and the means to deliver them effectively are actively pursued by rogue states like North Korea as well as Russia and China with regard to space implementation, the possibility of limited nuclear use may be on the rise. As Herman Kahn states in his book, Thinking About the Unthinkable in the 1980s, which still applies today, quote, some of the ideas regarding nuclear use by states are not on anyone's minds, but probably should be, end quote. Put another way, nuclear weapons exist, they are spreading, and as a result, the United States may face a situation where other countries may use them. And due to what many commentators call second mover advantage, where smaller countries like North Korea gains through learning from Russia and China, what does that mean for deterrence in space and escalation? And basically, also I would add, because of the growing alliance between these three regimes and the Iranians, is that something we should be thinking of more in depth? Deterrence theorists have modified their theory somewhat because of the different strategic context of the second nuclear age. The so-called third wave theorists, such as Keith B. Payne and Therese Delpech, argue that not all adversaries can be viewed as rational, reasonable, and predictive, and therefore a unified deterrence theory is ineffective in the modern world. In addition, the personal beliefs, intentions, and worldviews that exist in the multiplayer, multicultural environment of today's international system imply that more understanding of a state's strategic culture and decision-making calculus is required to effectively posture for credible deterrence. In addition to strategic culture, two scholars argue that not just any posture, but one capable of escalation dominance adds credibility to deterrence frameworks in this new nuclear age. Kerry Karchner and Michael Gerson have argued that strategies of escalation dominance claim to be more relevant to today's strategic environment than in the past. And this is because escalation dominance does not depend on shared commitment to a particular set of understandings or rules, and therefore might be more helpful in dealing with revisionist powers and states of concern that are either not invested in the international order's rules and norms or are trying to rewrite them through action. Escalation dominance, if done correctly, relies purely upon superior brute force and war-winning strategies, coupled with the credible threat to employ those forces and strategies if necessary. This credibility of threat is key. If a government or actor lacks the forces necessary to escalate or engage in a war-winning strategy, then escalation dominance will be lacking. An example of escalation dominance being successfully employed against the United States is the Russian use of nuclear posturing to deter NATO and U.S. intervention in both invasions of Ukraine in 2014 and just a few years ago. Russia postured its nuclear forces per its doctrine of escalate to de-escalate, and then the open threat to use those nuclear forces if any conventional force entered Russian territory. Escalation dominance was viewed as a credible possibility by NATO, and Russia seized Crimea and added it to the territory of the Russian state. And as we've seen now, the Donbas and other eastern regions are considered part of the Russian state as well. Another example of this lack of credibility where forces are lacking is in relation to the U.S. Space Force's current posture, where the general officers have basically said that the Space Force has everything that they need, But in reality, the Space Force does not have the forces to escalate to win, much less at the nuclear level, or even on the kinetic, regular, conventional ASAT use. So with this context in mind, and with the possibility of having to include higher threshold events or crises within the national security space strategy of the United States, one possible option based on so-called third wave thinking on deterrence and escalation dominance is what I refer to as the tiered tailored approach to space deterrence. Now, earlier today, I actually did a presentation to a group at Air Command and Staff College, and one of their questions was, what kind of change in strategy do you think is necessary for the new administration, regardless of who wins? And I said, well, I'm glad you asked that question. So here is what I think it should be, my tier-tailored approach to space deterrence. So I wrote a book in 2015 called Reversing the Tau that began with a look at the strategic level viewpoints necessary to understand the threat and operational environment within which all scenarios would play regarding DoD postures for deterrence in space. National leaders, therefore, should be required to acknowledge four items of importance to frame the situation that I mentioned in the book. So the first one is that American strategy and strategists should recognize that deterrence requires getting into the adversary's decision-making process through observation and analysis of its strategic culture, doctrine, and behavior. So in other words, intelligence collection needs to be more about the minds and the interests and the intentions of the adversary and less about their widgets. Widgets are important, but if you don't know why they built the widgets, then you're pretty much going to be ineffective in what you're trying to do. Second, strategists and policymakers must acknowledge that space is an offensive dominant medium. Now, this was a phrase used back as late as 2014, and then 2020 timeframe, it started to fall out of favor again, but it's still a true statement. As a result of this reality, in order to provide effective deterrence in a standard space power environment, meaning one that's below a nuclear threshold but above the non-kinetic day-to-day low-end jamming, much less at a nuclear higher threshold of the second nuclear age, the U.S. must actively protect its space systems through a credible offensive counterforce capability to reverse the first strike instability, at least up to the kinetic weapons threshold, if not up to a nuclear capability of its own. And I'm talking space related here, not nuclear posture, but space posture. So a kinetic anti-satellite's use could not only be a threat or use of force for active deterrence in the conventional sense, but could also be part of an adversary's nuclear strategy. Next up, theorists of the third wave suggest that any future national security space posture should acknowledge that damage limitation measures such as active defenses of U.S. critical space and terrestrial infrastructure are vital to ensure credible deterrence in environments of vertical escalation. Vertical escalation meaning operations and threats within one domain, such as the space world. Horizontal meaning you can expand it to operate in other domains such as air, land, and sea, or even cyberspace. So deployment of active defenses support the view expressed by second nuclear age scholars such as Keith Payne, who argues that to exercise force projection in regional contexts of the second nuclear age as means to deterrence requires management of risk to the U.S. homeland and deployed forces. To ensure an adequate management of risk requires damage limitation measures such as offensive capabilities for counterforce strikes, meaning hitting other space forces, active defenses such as air and ballistic missile defenses for any of the FOBs type fraction orbital bombardment systems or other weapons that may be deployed from space, and passive defenses such as physical protection and hardening against spaceborne electromagnetic pulse. Finally, policymakers and strategists must view space systems as a critical infrastructure of the United States and not just a support structure for force enhancement and terrestrial operations. The view of space systems as critical infrastructure has been a view in national strategy and doctrine for years in the past, not so much recently, but it has never been fully funded or executed broadly by senior leadership as a critical infrastructure normatively. So following the strategic framing necessary that I just mentioned to tailor deterrence to potential adversaries, this posture suggested in the framework in Reversing the Tau includes a tiered structure. So I break down each of the potential scenarios into a three-tiered structure, borrowing from Herman Kahn's type of structure for his nuclear viewpoints. So the Tier 1 space deterrence scenarios deal with the merger of the nuclear and the space power threats that could impact the homeland. Tier 2 space deterrence deals with most counter space threats across the counter space spectrum and up the vertical escalation ladder to everything short of nuclear anti-satellite or EMP use. And Tier 3 deterrence deals with a strictly reversible counter space threats and means to escalate. So day to day, we pretty much are living in a Tier 3 deterrence situation where we're attacked pretty much every day. So having the physical means to achieve escalation dominance is vital to this framework for space deterrence. And to help clarify the thresholds of escalation in a space power context, even those that combine with nuclear use, I put together a escalation ladder of sorts, again, similar to the one that was used for nuclear weapons by Herman Kahn back in the 1960s. So to explain an escalation ladder tool, the first threshold that I have in this ladder describes the ideal peacetime condition of non-interference and the international peaceful use of space. So nobody's messing with anybody, nobody's jamming anybody, nobody's shooting at anybody, and certainly nobody's nuking anybody. The first threshold above that describes conditions supported by customary norms, such as freedom of action in space, freedom of overflight, civil space exploration, commercial space development, and, of course, military uses of space for the national and multinational interests. In addition, it also includes military operations such as intelligence gathering, space situational awareness, space domain operations, also to ensure the status quo is maintained by all spacefaring nation states in the monitoring of arms control treaties, should there be any. The next threshold above that addresses the first level of purposeful attack along the reversible side of the counterspace spectrum. And examples, again, can include passive or active jamming of radio frequency communications, tracking or illumination by lasers upon surveillance satellites, unauthorized rendezvous and proximity operations near U.S. or allied spacecraft, or even posturing and mobilization of destructive space attack forces on Earth or even in orbit. This threshold has been the current norm of behavior in space for the last decade or so, in the sense that we have been essentially under attack consistently per senior Space Force leaders at the lower jamming threshold. And there's been demonstrations of kinetic weapons on again, off again for several years. The threshold above that, the space power escalation ladder, is the first set of damaging counter space attacks. So the threshold consists of two rungs of chemical laser use or high-powered microwave weapons, high-energy chemical lasers, and by the way, high-energy chemical lasers in the current context refer to mostly terrestrial-based laser systems, although high-energy lasers have been proposed and discussed for decades. Going back even to the Cold War, where deterrence theorists such as Dr. Payne have argued that deploying laser systems into orbit, especially for defensive purposes, could aid a nuclear deterrent stability. And some of that viewpoint seems to be coming back again in recent times. High-powered microwaves are another form of directed energy weapon that can produce effects that range from denying the use of electrical equipment on the spacecraft to disrupting, damaging, or destroying that equipment onboard space vehicles. And while these can deny and degrade spacecraft systems, these types of weapon systems, terrestrial-based or orbit-based, serve sort of as a bridge between the non-destructive and the destructive threshold of space attack. So once the kinetic threshold has been crossed, destruction of U.S. space assets is the adversary's clear objective within its destructive space warfare concept. So these rungs of escalation within the framework for space deterrence decision-making then becomes kinetic energy anti-satellite missiles, terrestrial-based, with ranges of low Earth orbit all the way up to geostationary Earth orbit. So that's from anywhere from 50 miles to about 22,000 miles thereabouts. In addition, co-orbital ASATs deployed in space are included within this threshold as well. And co-orbital ASATs are kinetic or even potentially non-kinetic weapons that can be based in orbit, various orbits, and used to strike other satellite targets, interceptors, and other attacking satellites. So while current counter space postures within this threshold are limited to terrestrial-based kinetic energy ASAT missiles and a few test co-orbital ASATs, future deployment modes could be multi-layered and multi-use for both space-on-space and space-to-ground attacks. And writings from near-peer potential adversaries such as China have indicated this for years, and recently demonstrated and deployed capabilities indicate that that multi-layered attack architecture is definitely key to their future space strategies. As one continues to the top of this escalation tool, the maximum damage that could be done is by crossing the nuclear use threshold. And While these less familiar weapon systems could be used to affect critical space infrastructure in orbit, destroy terrestrial targets such as power grids and command and control centers, or both. And this type of scenario constitutes what I call the tier one deterrence effect. So all those weapon system threats in the middle would be basically what's called a tier two. And tier one is when we get into the nuclear threshold. So again, one example of this could be electromagnetic pulse employed on a fractional orbital bombardment system or on a low Earth orbiting satellite, or even space-to-ground munitions, such as those demonstrated by China in the last couple of years, that included hypersonic glide vehicles dropping through potential holes in ground radar and space-based sensing grids. For those of you that, again, aren't familiar with electromagnetic pulse, EMP is defined as the interaction of high-energy nuclear radiation with the atoms of the atmosphere, causing damaging surges of electrical power. So in other words, when a nuclear explosion occurs at high altitude or in space, the electromagnetic pulse produces will cover a wide geographic region within the line of sight of the detonation, and this can produce widespread and long-lasting disruption or damage to ground-based critical infrastructures that underpin the fabric of U.S. society, to include the low orbiting, depending on the blast and where it was detonated, could create a problem for the low Earth orbiting critical space infrastructure that's also critical for the fabric of U.S. society. So I mentioned all this today because in the news there have been calls, and rightly so, there have been calls for a bigger budget and some growth in the Space Force to be able to provide the Space Force as necessary for terrestrial forces. And again, the focus has been primarily on what they call joint enablers, such as GPS and SATCOM and missile warning and all these wonderful things that are very important. But we have a situation, as seen here in what I mentioned earlier, and what we see in the news with everything from large numbers of mobile anti-satellite missiles deploying in countries, including potentially the North Koreans and the Iranians and the Russians and the Chinese, that they're not looking at just trying to deny our ability to get stuff. And so the mission of the Space Force and the U.S. Space Command should not be just to continue to be the Verizon of choice in the Department of Defense to make sure that signals are good. That's important. But in order to prevent that from happening, you got to have the ability to fight off the weapon systems that could be threatening you in the first place, and better yet, to deter it. Since the Space Force was established in late 2019, we're approaching the 50-year anniversary. A lot of senior leaders have really wasted this time in telling Congress what they need. For the first 3 years, everything was wonderful, everything's hunky-dory, we have what we need. Whereas the adversary continues to build all these capabilities from the low threshold counter-jamming kind of capabilities all the way up to now the news reports of nuclear ASATs being deployed. So we've essentially wasted 5 years where the Congress has said, "What do you need?" We said everything is great. And now some retired generals are finally starting to say what people like myself and others have been advocating for the last 5, 10 years, and that is our Space Force posture is not where it needs to be. We do not have the weapon systems we need, even on the low threshold of electromagnetic jamming, much less lasers and other high-end type of things. So it's really imperative that the next administration and the new Congress and Senate coming in early next year needs to really take this seriously and give the Space Force exactly what it needs and U.S. Space Command the authorities that it needs to act appropriately against adversaries that view deterrence as a proactive attack and not a passive defense mode. So with that, this is Chris Stone for Real Space Strategy. Thanks very much for listening. Thank you for listening to NIDS Knowledge, Real Space Strategy. The Real Space Strategy Edition is produced under NIDS Podcasting Network, a division of the National Institute for Deterrence Studies. NIDS is a 501c3 organization dependent on donations to provide this podcast and bring about awareness of the peacekeeping value of U.S. strength and our national deterrence. You can catch all of our podcasts or provide feedback at thinkdeterrence.com. I want to thank our producer, Kimberly Sherrington, our sponsors, and all the fantastic members of the National Institute for Deterrence Studies for making this podcast possible. Stay tuned next week for another exciting and informative NIDS Knowledge.